AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, Brett Johnson with you here on a Tuesday afternoon. Right now we're joined by Walker Orenstein. He reports on the state legislature for MinnPost and covers other Minnesota news as we are going to be talking about, well, something that of course has been in the news for the past week or so, and that is the police killing of Amir Locke, as there are questions now about the no-knock policy in not just Minneapolis, but the entire state, and then also what could happen with body cameras in light of what just happened. So Walker joins us now on the show to talk about all of these topics. Walker, thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me on. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. So what currently is Minneapolis's no-knock policy in light of what just happened with Amir Locke? Because I know Mayor Jacob Frey said he's going to issue a ban on no-knock warrants, but at least prior to Amir Locke getting killed, what was Minneapolis's policies on no-knock warrants?
Yeah, so prior to last week when the mayor announced a new policy, which he described sort of as a moratorium, and there are some exceptions, but prior to that, Minneapolis police had its first policy ever, like actually regulating, governing the use of no-knock search warrants in November of 2020. And so under that policy, officers had three options for searching a residence. The first is what's known as a knock and announce warrant. So that's sort of a situation where an officer goes up, they knock, they say, police, search warrant, they wait a reasonable amount of time, and generally they can't force their way into a building looking for evidence. And I know a professor from the University of St. Thomas's Law School told the city council yesterday that wait time is usually about 30 seconds. But under those new regulations, police can seek a no-knock warrant from a judge. The city usually refers to these sort of as unannounced entry search warrants. And so there's kind of the main option for police in most of these is that they have to announce themselves before entering a home, but not before opening a door or busting it down. So if you watch the video in the Locke case, officers, you know, use a key to open the door. And after that door is open is sort of when they announce themselves. So that's sort of the I guess, what I refer to as the middle tier of no-knock warrants, for lack of a better term, since there's three tiers here that we're talking about. And lastly, officers under these search warrant regulations issued by Minneapolis can decide if announcing themselves would create an imminent threat of physical harm to someone, they can enter without any type of knock or announcement. And the city said at the time this was sort of necessary only in limited circumstances, like something like a hostage situation. So there was these three tiers: knock and announce, breach and then announce, and enter. And no knock, no announcement. Those are sort of like the three options that police had under the previous policy.
So I know Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey announced that he is going to be banning most no-knock warrants. So what's actually in his new policy that has been announced? Are there any changes from what the previous policy was?
Yeah, there are some changes. So, you know, what he says is officers can only execute a search warrant under the knock and announce option generally. That's sort of limiting away the breach and then announce kind of option. He still said in extremely dangerous circumstances, an officer can enter without an announcement. He gave a couple examples: hostage situation, extreme domestic violence is another thing he said. So there is sort of an exception to that rule, but he took away kind of that middle tier and said, you know, officers can only really execute a knock and announce warrant unless it's one of these situations they consider to be, you know, limited and extreme.
So while the no-knock warrant policy in the city of Minneapolis has been garnering lots of attention, let's zoom out a little bit and talk about the state policy on no-knock warrants. What currently is the state policy?
Well, the state generally has some laws, you know, guiding no-knock warrants, which are issued by judges. And I'll just talk over some of the changes that they made in the last legislative session. You know, there are already sort of you know, judges' discretion. And I will say that police will tell you judges have a high bar for granting these, although that's, you know, always open to debate over whether the bar is adequately placed in granting these. But that's what they said, is it's not just like, you know, a rubber stamp necessarily. But regardless, the state last year enacted some new requirements last year for police using no-knock search warrants. First of all, they banned cops from using them in cases tied to drugs meant for personal use. So it still could be like a drug case tied to like distribution or something like that, but a case for personal use, they can't use it for. They said no-knock raids have to be approved by at least two officers in management. So that could be like a chief or a supervisor designated by the chief and another supervisor. Legislators set new guidelines for what police officers have to include in an application to a judge for a no-knock search warrant. For example, they have to say why a knock and announce entry can't be used, or whether the warrant could be actually carried out in daylight hours versus sort of at nighttime or early in the morning. And actually, lastly, the law requires police departments to report information to the state on no-knock warrants that they both applied for and that they carried out. And they have to say, you know, were there fatalities or injuries, that sort of thing. And there's no central database for this information, really. And police departments really seem to vary widely in how much they use these. You know, last year when I was writing about this, I talked to a lot of different types of agencies, you know, sheriff's departments, police departments, drug task forces, that sort of thing. And it really does vary widely in how and why they are used. And I will say the first couple months of that data, we got some limited data from that today, actually. We're working on writing a story for tomorrow on, you know, what we kind of learned from that. And so we're still drawing some conclusions from that. Frankly, it's a limited amount of information. But, you know, drug cases seem to be quite common, weapons cases, that sort of thing. But really there hadn't been any central clearinghouse for this sort of information. So legislators didn't really have a great understanding of, like, you know, what sort of is the standard usage across the state and who uses them and why and that sort of, you know, information.
Now, I know some changes are being proposed at the state legislature that have to do with these no-knock warrants, and there's a couple of different directions we can go. And let's start with this whole idea of the database that you were just bringing up a few moments ago, at least in some of these proposals that have been proposed at the state legislature. Are there any ideas in terms of trying to get that database running? Because I think it would be important to actually be able to access that information in terms of, yeah, who's actually being served these no-knock warrants, what's the result of these. Have we heard any talk about that from the state legislature with some of these proposed bills?
You know, they haven't weighed in on the database so much. I will say, you know, we got sent the data directly from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and it's early in the sense that legislators did require the state to issue a report every year on that information. So they do plan on sort of compiling that information themselves and sending it into a form to legislators, which will then theoretically be presented to the public. Usually those sorts of reports are released publicly. But what they said is usually they would do that after they actually accumulate a year's worth of data. So while they sent us the initial what they have, I think that report won't come out until there's a year's worth of data. So that aspect of it, I don't think legislators are as worried about it because they assume that some of that data is coming down the road here. But, you know, it's possible that they might want or ask for more real-time data or additional data, but that so far hasn't been raised necessarily at the Capitol.
So as the legislature continues to debate what's going to happen with the future of no-knock warrants, it seems like the big area of contention are what would qualify as exceptions to being able to use these no-knock warrants. That seems to be at least the big divide that we're hearing about from the state legislature are what actually qualifies for a scenario where you can use a no-knock warrant, because both Republicans and DFLers are open to restricting these no-knock warrants. It's more the case of, well, when can these be used and what the exceptions, correct?
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, Republicans have been careful about, but key Republicans particularly have been careful about, they haven't called for a complete and total ban. And initially some Democrats did call for what they said was to be a statewide prohibition. But it's important to note that the bill released by House Democrats today didn't actually include that. They limited them significantly, but they also did have exceptions. So I think it will be important for the legislature to sort of figure out what kinds of exceptions that they want. And Republicans have said, you know, we think that these are necessary in some circumstances. So there could be a great divide. Honestly, that sort of specifics are still kind of playing out. I think that we will learn more about that in the days to come. For instance, the DFL legislators today, they released sort of what they expect the bill to do, but they didn't even have their bill policy language, like the specifics written out that would become law, released to the public yet. So really, we're kind of in the early stages. It's still possible that they disagree so much that nothing is done on no-knock warrants. It's very possible, but it seems like that there is bipartisan support to at least sort of examine if there are ways to change no-knock policy again this year.
Speaking with Walker Orenstein, he reports on the state legislature for MinnPost with a particular focus on covering issues affecting greater Minnesota. Also reports on Minnesota politics as well. Make sure you go to MinnPost.com for the latest with Walker's work. Another piece I know you wrote very recently has to do with, well, the legislative push for more body cameras and how it could hinge on how and when police are required to release footage to families. So I guess my first question, Walker, is that we often hear when police departments are talking about getting these body cameras is that cost has always been the big prohibiting factor in terms of getting these cameras. So I guess it's a two-part question. How many departments actually have these body cameras, and what are the costs of getting these cameras actually installed? I know there's been some estimates released, but talk through both of those in terms of how many departments actually have these, and then the costs of trying to get these body cameras implemented as well.
Yeah, so here's kind of the data that I do have. Governor Tim Walz's administration estimates that there are 9,000 officers, roughly 9,000 officers in the state unequipped with body cameras. And they say it costs roughly $1,000 per officer each year to buy and to use them. So there's sort of ongoing costs. It's not just, you know, buying the cameras, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And there was a survey, recent survey released in July of 2021 by the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. And they found that a number of body cameras among police departments actually doubled in the last 5 years. So more and more departments are adopting these. But even so, they had 214 chiefs who responded, and 95 said they still don't have the technology. And generally of those 95, I think it's greater than 50%. If I remember, it's about 65% said that cost was really the big, you know, issue here. And so it remains to be a really expensive thing. And I know, there was a police shooting down in Austin, Minnesota, where officers killed a man down there in late December. And the Austin Police Department did not have body cameras. And I talked to the department there, and they said, you know, it was a mixture of things. They do plan on adopting body cameras. Money is certainly a factor. Sort of making sure they have the right technology and the logistics surrounding implementing these sorts of things was a really big factor for them. But, you know, they've got to hire staff. They said they have to hire an assistant to do data work, you know, $80,000 or more per year. The initial equipment and infrastructure could be $160,000 per year. I mean, these are real costs for department. And they said they were initially just kind of hesitant to adopt these early because they worried, like, if they didn't work well, they weren't the right type, if police departments decided they weren't really helpful, it could be a big expense for them. So they didn't really want to be an early adopter, as they put it. So they were kind of waiting back and learning to some extent. So now they do plan to adopt them, but they said more money from the state certainly could help. But yeah, for now, that cost issue remains really big for a lot of police departments.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, there does seem to be some general agreement among members of the state legislature and even Governor Walz that the state should be helping pay for these body cameras. But in terms of trying to actually get a bill that would provide that funding passed, well, there is a sticking point, and that has to do with the disclosure and timing of footage from these body cams when you have a police-involved shooting. Talk a little bit about at least what the current law is in terms of releasing body cam footage when you do have a police-involved shooting, and at least what the divide is between the Republicans and the Democrats in the state legislature in terms of that timing on when footage could be released.
Yeah, so under state law, usually these kinds of body camera videos from incidents where police use deadly force are tied to an investigation, and that's generally considered private while the investigation is ongoing. You know, police agencies can decide themselves that they should release the video if it will dispel rumors or quash unrest promote public safety, there's sort of a broad exemption there. Like, hey, if you want to release this because you think it's going to stop this, you know, protest or whatever it is, you're allowed to do that. But it's sort of up to each agency. And, you know, a coworker of mine, Solomon Gustavo, wrote recently a story about how Minneapolis itself has been pretty inconsistent with releasing this footage. And, you know, the mother of Kobe Dimmick Heisler, a man with autism who was fatally shot in Brooklyn Center in August of 2019, his mother actually testified at the legislature that she didn't get to see the footage from her son's death until months later, really, 4 days after George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis. And so she felt like, you know, I don't want public pressure to be the only reason that this footage is released or not. And so Democrats have pushed, especially in the House, Democrats control the House, Republicans control the Senate. They last year wanted any police department that gets money through this grant program to have to allow families to view that footage within 48 hours. And there are some exceptions and, you know, there's little complicating factors, but that was the general thrust of it. In most circumstances, within 48 hours, the family of somebody who was killed by police gets to watch the video. And, you know, police departments and Republicans both said that they worried that that would sort of interfere with the investigative process. You know, they have to the state has to interview people involved as they're determining, you know, whether there should be any criminal charges in the case, that sort of issue. And so they said it takes a while to do that, and we can't have the body camera footage released until then. So this year, actually, House Democrats introduced another bill that has a 7-day timeline for family to view the police footage. And it also says, you know, if the chief of a department has a compelling reason to not release that footage, that they can do so, but that within 90 days, it has to be released to the family. So there's kind of a two-part, you know, release mechanism there. It's a little too early to tell exactly what Republicans think of that. I know police groups still thought that the decision should be made either by local police departments on their policy for releasing footage, or they felt like the 7-day timeline was still too short. Republicans have talked about maybe letting some of these issues around body camera footage and disclosure of that footage be decided by a committee that has oversight over public records in Minnesota. And so they've wanted some more conversation around that. I will say that they last year said that they offered a 30-day window for that footage to be released to families. And they said House Democrats didn't go for that. So there's sort of this divide over it. And it's worth noting, Democrats last year wanted to apply that 48-hour window both broadly to all departments in one bill and specifically to departments getting money under these grants. And last year, at the end of the legislative session, the legislative leaders actually agreed to some money for these body cameras, and they put it in the bill that was passed around to reporters. You know, here's our final negotiated compromise bill, and there was money for this kind of grant program. But after sort of legislators realized the scope of the police accountability agreement, which they had been negotiating, they felt like they hadn't gotten enough and they were frustrated with having money in there that did not have these regulations. So they actually pulled it back out of the bill. And so it didn't pass. So this has been a real divide on this issue. And if it doesn't get solved, then there'll probably still just be more police departments that don't have body cameras. It's kind of the upshot of it.
Yeah, so still lots more to do on that before a final bill could be put together that could provide funding, at least statewide, for some of these departments that do not yet have those police body cameras. We have been speaking with Walker Orenstein, who reports on the state legislature for MinnPost with a focus on covering issues affecting greater Minnesota, also covers Minnesota politics as well. Find all of his work over at MinnPost.com. Again, MinnPost.com. Walker, thanks so much for joining me on the show today. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, let's take a break and send things back over to Matt McNeil on AM 950.